Are we on?
Yes, we are.
Okay. I'd like to call the House Finance Committee meeting to order. We do have a quorum today with Representatives Navarre, Foster, Terrio, myself, Hanley, Mulder, Martin, Parnell, Coring, and Grusendorf. Actually, the first thing I'd like to do is introduce our new assistant, Marta Lastupka.
Hey!
If you'd raise your hand. She's taking over from Michael, who has another job now. So she'll be doing a lot of the work for us here in the last couple of weeks of session. I just wanted everybody to be aware of who she is. She is another Diamond High School graduate, I would note, as am I and Vic. So we're starting to dominate things down here, I think. Don't hold that against her, though.
I'm just kind of...
Do we have anybody... I think what we're going to do is start off on... Senate Bill 92, and which is the HFC subject to the Executive Budget Act. Is someone here from the sponsor's office, or are you, Mr. Bitney? Are you the Budget and Audit Committee? Is that
sure, Mr. Chairman? For the record, my name is John Bitney. I'm staff to the Chairman of the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. The bill that you have in front of you, Senate Bill 92, was sponsored at the unanimous request of the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. It's started off as an attempt to bring all activities of the corporation under the review procedures of the Executive Budget Act. Basically, the idea was on the part of the committee to bring those programs that are currently exempted from review by the legislature within the scope of what we approve annually in the budget. At this point, mainly it's... basically mostly the loan programs and the financing programs of the corporation. The concern at the time was that the corporation had undertaken a fairly substantial program to with the use of arbitrage funds and lent them out on a 5% rate, which had a significant impact on the market. And the committee was concerned enough about the corporation having the ability to set up these kinds of programs that it basically introduced the bill. Once the bill came over to the House, it was amended in the House State Affairs Committee, and which is the version that you have in front of you now. The State Affairs Committee did place some exemptions in the bill on page 2, beginning on line 8. There's basically three things that the State Affairs Committee placed into the bill that would be exempted from the review procedures. The first one is number A there, starting on line 8 on page 2, would be the bonding money, the financing that the corporation does through the sale of bonds. B on line 12 would be multifamily loans and projects not to exceed $10 million. And then the last one would be any loan programs for which a subsidy is not required. Those, again, would be exempt from the review procedures. I'd just like to say, Mr. Chairman, for the record, when we had started the bill where we would bring all activities of the corporation under the Executive Budget Act, what was envisioned at that time, I guess, was not so much to set up a process where we would be exempting things from the Executive Budget Act, rather to craft language to be added to what we already provide for the corporation in the front section where... Right now, the corporation in the front section of the budget, for those portions that the legislature does approve, receives basically open-ended authorization to perform those functions. And by bringing all activities of the corporation, what was envisioned at that time was that we would expand on that front section language just to basically give the corporation open-ended authority for all those programs that were being brought under the review procedures of the legislature. We did have... legislative legal draft some appropriation language where if the original bill had passed, that we would have requested the committee to consider moving that appropriation language into an appropriation bill for this session to bring all those, to give the corporation appropriation authority for all those new items. But at this point, of course, what you see in front of you is that the State Affairs Committee has added some exemptions to it. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll try to answer any questions if anybody has any.
We also have Mr. Williams here, who's representing Senator Frank's office. It's a Senate bill, so maybe we can hear from Mr. Williams. Representative Brown.
Thank you. How would you characterize what would be different from the status quo
if the state affairs version is adopted, what things would be under the Budget Act that are not under it now, considering the exemptions in that proposal?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brown, the way the statute is worded now, if you kind of look at the bill, you can kind of see what the language that's being deleted to kind of get an idea of the way the statute is set up now. And it basically, it says it counts in what is under the authority of the legislature is the way it's set up. I'm looking at the state affairs version, for example, here, and you can see the current language is what's being deleted there in the bold text, or in the capitalized text, where it says the provisions of the Executive Budget Act apply to, then you have the operating budget of the corporation, amounts payable from corporate earnings or assets, basically the grant programs. C, you have the interest rate subsidies, et cetera, that are laid out there. You know, you'll note the exception for the arbitrage earnings. But anyway, now the way the bill is set up is it's going the other way and saying that all activities are included except for the three things that the State Affairs Committee has laid out. So in the past, what was excluded were all the loan programs that the corporation ran, as well as all their bonding authority, their use of arbitrage to set up programs. And right now, the way the State Affairs Committee has set up the bill is that we would be approving basically all the grants. They would have to come for approval for any kind of arbitrage program, and as well as basically any kind of subsidized project or program that exceeds the cost of $10 million.
Thank you.
Mr. Williams, did you have some statements?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Tom Williams. I'm staff to Senator Frank. The original version, as indicated, was all-encompassing. The exceptions listed by the House State Affairs Committee raised some concerns as to either it actually makes it or may make it less subject to the Executive Budget Act than what it is under current statute. For example, under Section B, page 2, line 12, multifamily loans and projects not to exceed $10 million individual that may require grants or tax credits used as subsidies may suggest that those provisions of the grants may not be subject to the Executive Budget Act if this version were to pass. Therefore, we have some real concerns about the current version. I would prefer to see it go back to the original version, or absent that, some different definition of those portions that would be exempt.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. Any questions at this point? We have a couple people that would like to testify. Maybe you guys could. Mr. Sieverts, did you want to join us? A joint testimony?
Yeah,
that's fine.
No,
that's
fine, Mr. Chairman.
We like saving money.
Yeah, money and time.
And time. If you could both, for the record, just identify yourselves.
I'm Jan Sieverts. I'm with National Bank of Alaska.
And I'm Cynthia Parker, and I'm the Executive Director of Anchorage Neighborhood Housing Services. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Basically, I'd like to speak in favor of the State Affairs Committee substitute. We participated in most of the hearings that were teleconferenced at State Affairs on this particular bill, and a number of problems cropped up that the committee members took heed to, and they were really around issues that had some consequences that would be a grave disservice, we feel, to Alaskans if this committee substitute weren't actually enacted. For example, if all of the loan programs were, all of the activities of AHFC were brought under the Executive Budget Act, there was some concern that AHFC as a corporation could not take advantage of the financial markets that move very quickly and could change very dramatically over a period of a year, or even over a period of, a 45-day period that may be required to call the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee together to hear something. For example, interest rate swings can take place over a three-day period, and if Alaskans were locked into a particular interest rate under a particular loan program that was authorized by the legislature, then the corporation might not be able to move as quickly. And these would be loans that would not require a subsidy of any type, just HFC acting in its capacity as a bond issuer. So that was item number C, and also really covered the obligations of the corporation under item number A. Item number B really refers to some of the programs that are really necessary to fund multifamily housing projects. And most multifamily project housing projects in Alaska today that can be built usually involve some sort of a what is called a subsidy layering. And most of these subsidies are coming from grant programs from the federal government. For example, there's a program called HOME that the federal government annually appropriates about $3 million to the state for HFC to take to the legislature under the Executive Budget Act as a program that is a pass-through. But as we read the language, it was felt that individual projects would have to come up before LBNA. And because the complexity of these projects, it usually takes up to sometimes five different funding sources to make a project work. And so adding in the factor of having to be responsible to say, you know, the Federal Home Loan Bank, which may provide a subsidy, tax credits, which are passed through the state's taxing authority, the federal government's taxing authority to give tax credits that are allocated by Alaska Housing, and then say a federal grant program, and then having to wait for the legislature to approve that individual project when the program itself would be brought under the Executive Budget Act seemed to be redundant and could really cause some problems and wreak some havoc. So we support the committee substitute, and I think Mr. Sieberts can speak as a banker that's financed a number of these projects and how it would cause some problems. So thank you.
Mr. Sieberts? I'm Jan Sieberts, once again, from National Bank of Alaska, and we are involved in working on meeting the housing needs of the people of the state of Alaska from Ketchikan to Point Barrow. And we have found over the years that Alaska Housing Finance Corporation has been a good partner in meeting those tasks. Our concern here, and we support the amended version of the bill, and our support being that we feel that Alaska Housing Finance has to be given the flexibility to conduct business. We're involved in a lot of these major projects, either senior citizen or low-income project, and many of these projects, due to increased costs and without a corresponding increase of income of our citizens, require more complex financing vehicles to accomplish. For instance, the North Star Council of the Aging is doing a senior citizen project in Fairbanks that we're involved in, $4 million, and that project includes federal grant, the use of arbitrage funds, the use of federal tax credits, with National Bank of Alaska is investing $1.5 million into the project in equity, and other forms of assistance. You know, if after spending nearly a year putting that project together, we'd have to go back to the legislature for specific approval, as some of our consultants say we would have to in that project, make it very difficult. And we don't like the idea of spending that much time and having these projects that are meritorious to be turned down for some political reasons or whim that we have no control over. We believe that Alaska Housing's projects, like ADA, should be done on a merit basis and not on a political favoritism basis. The ADA has a $10 million authority to do loans without coming to the legislature, and it seems for us that it would be reasonable for you to give Alaska Housing Finance a similar level of authority. And then business could continue without a great deal of disruption.
Representative Parnell, and then Martin.
I just wanted to ask a quick question. I want to know for the record what the intent is. Page 2, lines 12 through 14, it says multifamily loans and projects not to exceed $10 million individually. And as it was explained to me by you, Mr. Parker, you could have an 80-unit or 82-unit complex, $10 million bucks, 80% of which is financed by other means. And HFC participates at the level of $2 million, for instance. Does this $10 million apply to AHFC's participation level, or is it applied to the entire package? I don't think it's written. I mean, it says multifamily loans. It's just not as clear as I think it could be.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Parnell, that's a good question. We talked about it earlier in your office. I frankly interpret this as a $10 million cap on the project, not necessarily on AHFC's participation. Although I think Mr. Sieverts was speaking to the loan authority of ADA, which is $10 million, and that would be probably more consistent if that were clear.
Representative Martin, and then
Yeah, well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a much larger problem here than what Mr. Sieverts has been projecting, that the political wimp or political whatever excuse for us sticking our nose in the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation business. And that came to a heading, I guess, last December when the 5% arbitrage came through and many realtors and many commercial people got real excited and were trying to find out what in the world are they doing. And we really didn't know what the world they were doing, except that some of the senators thought that this was the responsibility of the Budget and Audit Committee right now, because it has the total state responsibility of the financial well-being of the state. So more or less that's how our committee got into it, as being the only vehicle available right now that can oversee, much as we oversee Alaska Railroad, much as we oversee the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, they come to us for different type of bondings, much as we oversee ADA, and it's one other corporation. But it was found out that there's a major loophole when we combine Alaska State Housing Authority with ASHA, and all the things that the legislators did in detailed studies, some of which we did last Saturday with Representative Foster's capital budget committee, was $71 million there. So we did take the time, he was patient with me, to bring out all these budget, all these grants, all these things that we did do in a normal process. It was thought with the legislative budget and audit committee that maybe the best we can do to monitor our constitutional responsibility of the total financial welfare of the state, that at least they should be under the Budget and Audit Committee. And so that's where we stand now, through the executive budget guidelines. So that was the minimum of interference that the Budget and Audit Committee came up, and that was recommended by our specialists to do at this time. It wasn't to needle and thread and to pick and nickel. It was also just the opposite of what it said by some, that as we interfere with ASHA, the financial markets of Moody, the financial market of whoever over there are watching us, put us on watch. And our feeling was, well, we sure and hope that you look at us, and we're going to watch the welfare, financial welfare of the state too. And we thought that maybe our ratings would be increased for bonding authority rather than decrease, because Alaska, it's not just Alaska Housing, it's Alaska bonding rate is at stake too if they go too far in using a so-called moral obligation of Alaska's financial well-being. And it's no small organization. It's between $5 and $7 billion of assets, which in one technicality you may say belong to the state of Alaska. And should we just close our eyes and not look? And especially with the numerous loans that you saw in the budget the other day, that under capital improvement, but they're actually loans that we used to argue about day in and day out. Should the legislators not look at those anymore? Should we see what kind of use or misuse of money? The one thing that came out is the weatherization program, a report they did themselves by ISA, showed very, very poor financial responsibility. And yet they say, keep your nose out of our business, it's none of yours. They only want $10 million more this year. Over the years, they've had over $78 million. No one's really done an audit on them to find out, what are we getting out of weatherization? It all sounds good. But anyway, this is the whole idea, ladies and gentlemen, right now. It looks like that we as legislators have suddenly become confronted with the putting together, it's only 2 years old, of these two agencies. And somehow ever, we as legislators and the future legislators had better look at what's going on with the monies, even though they said, oh, it's all federal monies, it's all federal monies. Well, originally we were combining 20 to to 80, and now some organization want us to combine 30 to 70. And so, you know, if we let a agency like this just do as they want, have we negated our constitutional responsibility? That's the way I'm looking at it from right now. I could say no thanks for the work and just let them go the way they want. But I really think we have a major, major responsibility right now of overseeing this group and seeing how much money is involved and where does it stop? Because even though the bank's behind it, no way in the world these things are going to pay for themselves. So somewhere along the line, Alaska's going to be stuck with the bill.
Representative Corey?
I'd like to ask Mr. Martin, what bill are you talking about?
The bill for housing. The 20%, the 30%, the arbitrage, the interest.
There's nothing that the, Mr. Chairman, if I may, there's nothing that is going to be encumbering on the part of the legislature as far as any debt that the corporation is accumulating, given its strong financial status right now. I mean, if this situation were to change drastically over the years, I suppose, perhaps eventually down the road, but as it stands right now, HSC is a very financially strong and solvent corporation. There's no indebtedness that the legislature is going to have to pick up the tab on. But, Mr. Chairman, if I may, Cynthia, you had suggested on this committee substitute here on line 12, letter B, adding in the word programs here after the word loans so that it would also incorporate loan programs within HSC, including the Loan and Sponsors Program. Would you mind elaborating on that, please?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Coring, certainly. When the committee substitute was offered up and there was much discussion on it, I think that the intent was that the $10 million cap would be a $10 million cap so that the legislative oversight would still be there under the Executive Budget Act, and we certainly wouldn't see the legislature would certainly review programs of the magnitude of the 5% loan program that Representative Martin was talking about under this version, but that multifamily loans itself might be a little too restrictive. For example, HFC has a program called Loans to Sponsors, and that program is funded by arbitrage, which would come under the Executive Budget Act, but individual borrowers of the Loans to Sponsor program might come up with a program that might not be a multifamily project. For example, in Fairbanks, the Fairbanks Neighborhood Housing Services Group is rehabbing houses in Cushman, which is a distressed neighborhood. And the way the language read and excluded that particular program, they might have to come as an individual borrower, and they're only borrowing $500,000 under the Loans to Sponsors back to legislative budget and audit. So it really was consistent with the intent, was just to clean up that particular language.
Mm-hmm. So you'd prefer to have, Mr. Chairman, if I may, as part of this committee substitute, an amendment that would add in the word program?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Coring, yes, sir.
And perhaps also, if I may continue, modifying that sentence so that it's clear that it would be AHSC's participation of $10 million as opposed to the entire project. So perhaps something to the effect of, if I may quote, multifamily loans, comma, programs, comma, and projects not to exceed, say, AHSC's participation of $10 million individually that may require grants or tax credits, et cetera. Would that be sufficient, do you think?
Representative Coring, that would be consistent with ADA's authority. That's correct. That would be fine.
Representative Mulder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Cynthia, right after, in conjunction with Representative Coring's question, the programs, I understand, projects. What specifically? Which projects are referred to in the bill or are alluded to?
Representative Mulder and Mr. Chairman, multifamily projects would refer to an individual borrower who would come to the corporation and would ask to borrow money for a project. Today, $10 million sounds like a lot of money, but it actually, with today's construction costs, doesn't really buy a lot. $10 million probably equates to about an 82-unit project. You're not going to see a lot of those, but you're not going to get a lot of units for much more than that.
I could continue, Mr. Chairman, for follow-up. So, Cynthia, those projects are basically geared toward or focused toward the low income?
They're primarily focused toward the low income, although there might be some other special needs that you would see. I think an example might be the Chester Park Cooperative that's in your district. That was a project that was funded with grants and with a modest amount of loan from HFC.
And how much, break do builders get? Is this money that cannot come through MBA or another lending source? And is just straight market value loan, or is it another type?
Typically, the way those financings work is that if HFC takes a debt piece that they're lending, that is typically at the market rate. There are usually a number of other sources that would need to fund it. And, of course, the construction lender would be not HFC. It would be a private lending source because they are not participating in construction projects, only in the permanent takeout financings. It may require a subsidy such as a tax credit, though, which is allocated to the state and then allocated to an individual project, and then an investor is found for the tax credit. And that might be a bank like an MB of A or a Key Bank or a First National. Corporations with some profits, they are participating in those projects. But that's what gets the debt down and makes them an equity partner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Parnell and then Martin.
I just wanted to follow up because I understood your answer to my earlier question to be that $10 million applies to you believe $10 million applies to HFC's participation is what you would now, what I'm hearing you say now?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Parnell, I said that would be consistent with ADA's borrowing authorization.
Okay.
Lending authorization.
Well, I'm struggling with clarifying what they did in State Affairs, and you're not the appropriate person to tell me what their intent was when they did this. But let's go back to the question of $10 million. If we assume that, I'm trying to get a picture for how big $10 million really is in relation to these programs. The complex in my area, which you're acquainted with, is Spruce View. It's an 82-unit facility. What percentage of those are for low income? Is it 40% roughly?
Representative Parnell, that is 100% low income project.
Okay. And HFC's participation in those kinds of projects, how often does HFC get up to the $10 million level, if ever?
In that particular project, and in most of the projects that Neighborhood Housing Services has proposed, we have brought other funding sources to the table beyond HFC, so HFC's piece has been smaller. HFC's actually participated about $4.5 million in that project out of an $11 million budget.
Yeah, but I'm talking on a macro level, is that usual, $4.5 million, or on other multifamily loans and programs, is HFC's participation... I mean, in other words, what I'm getting at is, should the number be $10 million? Should it be $5 million? Should it be $15 million? I mean,
sure.
Where's the justification?
Well, I think that the justification really is that each financing is probably fairly unique. And, for example, HFC has a program for for-profit equity extraction and refinancing of some of the properties that are around town, and that's a market-driven type of conventional financing. And if we were to see refinancings under that particular program, which they're developed regulations for, you would probably see some $10 million projects if interest rates were competitive enough to make it attractive for borrowers at that point.
Well, right now, $10 million is an upper limit.
It's an upper limit.
That has really never been reached for multifamily loans and programs?
With few exceptions, that's true, as far as HFC's participation is concerned.
Right.
But it's an average for a project.
Well, I think in the Chester Park project, it was a $10 million participation by Alaska Housing, if I'm not mistaken.
Representative Martin.
Well, I think, Mr. Chairman, just a short discussion brings up the tremendous financial power and influence in the state that Alaska Health and Finance has. and you only heard a small shell of it. When you look into just here, here's partial capital budget of $71 million that he wants us to prove. It shows you that the legislators better look at it. You don't say, we got rid of that problem, thank God, because they are dealing with hundreds of million dollars. And there is no doubt that the Alaska Housing had developed a tremendous force behind it. The Home Builders Association, the Bankers Association, the Real Estate Association, because there is hundreds of millions of dollars in contracts to lay out. And it should be so easy for me or anyone else to say, hey, look, I'm not going to fight my right-wing conservative people. You know, that's the way you can make money. If you can get hundreds of millions of dollars a year from a federal government that's broke, fine, grab what you can and run like mad. And when we're building units like here in Juneau, the last one I read in the papers yesterday, the president said, look at this here new development in Juneau. I think it's 36 units, and it would be $195,000 per unit. And this is for the so-called poor people. But what we call poor, we asked the other day from the specialist that were here, what is your bottom line of poor? $20,000, $25,000, $36,000? The last I read in the paper, poor is going to be $36,500. But the experts that were here didn't know. So the point was that you keep on raising this lower level, and every one of us, we found out, are available, all legislators were qualified. And you know, that gets ridiculous. So we're looking at another thing from my mind. Who is going to control the total housing market of Alaska? You want private enterprise to do it, or you want the government to do it? And if you want the government to do it, is the legislature going to have any input whatsoever on it? And if you're going to provide a $195,000 home for a so-called poor person, what about the person, single mother, who's working hard as can be, who's just above the poor market, and she has to pay $1,100 or $1,400 a month for her house? That's what I think we better look into. What is this government agency going to do? And to have them under the authority of some, even legislative budget and audit and executive act, is minor. It was literally overlooked from what I heard, the way this bill was put together so quick when Senator Rohde was here. No one looked at the final, well, look, after we put it together and merge it together, how are we going to monitor it? Wasn't even thought of. Most people said at the beginning of the year in our budget, and all the people said it should at least been under the Executive Budget Act. But we let it go.
Mr. Sievers. Representative Martin, Representative Hanley, I think the bill that you have here substantially brings Alaska Housing under control of some of the abuses that I've heard you speak to and the legislature speak to, the arbitrage program, the building that people, some people objected to. I think what we have here is, basically a compromise which allows Alaska Housing to continue to do some business without jeopardizing or extending projects to the point of hurting the projects. For instance, if we do a project in Unalakleet, you know, we have to get the materials and supplies to the barge by a certain date or it won't get there so the project can be seasonably completed. If we have to wait for a legislature or a budget committee to convene, they may or may not think it's important to convene. They may not be able to do it in a timely manner. What this amendment does to this bill is it allows this organization to operate. Another issue that's brought up here, and I don't know, I didn't intend to bring this up, but you talk about, government involvement in housing. There's no non-government involved in anybody's house. Nobody that gets a loan. I mean, you have Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, Jenny Mae, HUD, FHA, which does almost all the new construction homes in the state, Indian Housing, Farmers Home, and Alaska Housing. It operates basically as a conduit to help us, go to the capital markets and gives Alaska a lot of clout. But the U.S. government underwrites the housing industry of the United States, and we don't kid ourselves to think that we, the National Bank of Alaska, which provides about 40% of the home mortgages in the state, are capable of going out and doing all this by ourselves. We won't be able to do it. We just ask for a reliable partner.
Thank you. Representative Terrio.
Well, just with respect to the question that Representative Parnell had and whether that $10,000 for the project or the participation in your comments that you'd like to see it brought into line with ADA. But I think ADA's participation in a road project or a port facility or something like that you know, those a lot bigger monetary terms when we start talking about those projects. I guess I do have a little bit of concern if this $10 million is just HSC's portion. I guess my preference would be to see it, the project.
Representative Coring and then Mulder.
Just wanted to make a comment in regard to private enterprise and that they would pick up where AHSC would left off, the AHSC right out of the picture. I'm not quite sure how that would be. You know, AHSC is a very unique institution in that it's kind of like a lender of last resort where other investors, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, Ginnie Mae, all those that Jan made reference to, will not invest in, you know. And if they're not investing in loans in Alaska, providing those loans available to Alaskans, that's where AHSC steps in and provides loans for those that not normally have access to loans for housing. Wanted to make that point. And then also, the entire banking industry, as far as I know it, and mortgage lending industry out there is very concerned about the restrictions that this legislation poses here, and I think we need to take that into serious consideration. I mean, the legislature seems gung-ho to rein in AHSC, but I think the legislature should also listen to what the community is saying out there, to what contractors are saying, to what the banking industry is saying, and they're all saying this is bad legislation. So I think we're rushing a little bit too quickly with this to perhaps react in a knee-jerk fashion to what's happened lately with this building and with the 5% money. I think we need to be careful here before we make a ill-advised decision here on this bill here that could ultimately cost thousands of people in Alaska a whole lot of money. So just wanted to make that observation. Thank you.
Representative Navarro.
You sound like a market
Could either of you, or would either of you like to hazard a guess as to what percentage of the financing that's available from HFC now would be available through other means, either private or other government funding? Because not everything that HFC does is necessary. It's nice to have, and it helps drive the economy and housing market.
That's true. We may both have an answer. I guess, Mr. Chairman, Representative Navarro, I would say that it changes with the changing interest rates and changing market conditions around the country. For example, AHFC shrunk back their participation in single-family lending as other secondary market sources came into the state of Alaska. However, those forces dry up and come back depending on what's happening. Is Boston a hot button right now? Are they going to be concerned about oil-driven economies? They can dry up completely almost overnight. So the creation of Alaska Housing to be able to serve as a backstop, I certainly don't think that they should be the lion's share of that particular market, but to be a backstop so that mortgage money is available in the state is very, very important. Rural Alaskans really had a disadvantage until the merger occurred because the legislature said by statute that we are going to fix the interest rate for rural loans at a point and a half below what HFC could go out in the marketplace and get, unsubsidized. And with the merger, HFC was able to make rural loans, and they are making rural loans now, which is still a place where normal secondary markets won't lend, and they're making them at very competitive rates, as competitive as people in Anchorage enjoy. So it really depends on where you're lending in the state. The urban areas are still easy to lend in. The rural areas are not. And it depends on what the rest of the country is doing. In terms of the multifamily loans, most of the secondary market investors are still size of the loans, and HSC is probably the primary lender for multifamily loans. But I can tell you, we keep a very active role in financing sources that are available around the country. And right now, I would say that there would still be some ability to attract outside capital for multifamily, but not necessarily for any of the smaller projects that would probably impact your district or, say, a Fairbanks, a 24-unit, because most of the capital markets are looking at bigger projects right now. And that's just a snapshot today.
Well, I can speak from NBMA's involvement in the business, and we service about $2.1 billion worth of loans, and of that, about $900 million represents Alaska Housing Finance. So by far, and again, the largest segment is Alaska Housing Finance. In rural Alaska, Alaska Housing Finance is probably the only source of money because conventional lenders aren't very interested. And the mortgage companies that have come into the state that lend, kind of high-grade the market, they take the top third of the market as far as quality of borrowers and things, and aren't very interested in serving the rest of the market. You pull Alaska Housing, which it probably deals with the bottom two-thirds of the market fairly effectively out of the marketplace, those other folks that are high-grading the market will probably be gone in a flash. As far as multifamily, you know, in the United States today, what the biggest financing of multifamily projects in the country is through what they call conduit financing. The conduit financing folks aren't interested in coming to this marketplace, period. Now, there are a few lenders, you know, that mortgage companies that have worked with HUD. You know, it takes them up to a year to put a mortgage together. Not very conducive to reasonable, you know, sustaining a established financial market. Alaska Housing, I've worked with them actually after a conversation with Terry Martin, who said that there was no vehicle for financing for the private apartment house owner, went and worked with Alaska Housing Finance and have put together a participation program similar to the way ADA operates. So banks underwrite and originate the apartment house loans, which will enable apartment house owners who are entrapped in their projects, they can't sell because there's no financing, they can't raise equity to do improvements to existing projects. That project is sitting there ready to go, or that program is sitting ready to go, but they haven't been able to spring it loose yet, even though they approved the regulations. So rural housing, you know, outside of a few HUD projects that are sporadic, Alaska Housing has a rural housing program that works pretty good up to 12 units.
Chairman, I just go back to in the discussion about the different programs. I remember when we had the program, rural housing program under CNRA, and we went through several different definitions to try to figure out what was rural and what wasn't, and it was a fiasco. And what ended up happening is because of the subsidy in that program, realtors pushed everybody who could access that program into that program, even though other financing was available. And because it's a smart thing to do for personally buying a home, if you can get it cheaper, you take it cheaper. I guess I've got some additional questions, Mr. Sievert. One is, of the $900 million which you use AHFC financing, how much of that portion do you think would be you could displace with other lending sources?
Well,
because here's what I'm getting at. You said that HFC is the bottom two-thirds of the market, which serves to prop up the upper third of the market, which seems to me that we're making it available for high grading because we artificially prop up the bottom two-thirds, which means our whole housing economy is driven up and the prices are driven up because the availability of financing and this idea that someone mentioned earlier about whether or not we're keeping an eye on what's happening with oil revenues in an oil-driven economy, which the state of Alaska has. And if we look back at what happened to AHFC when we went through another false economy that we'd built in the mid-'80s through capital spending, I'm just a bit concerned that the financial security of HFC, which is now good, could be significantly at risk with another downturn in the economy. And not only that, that most of the risk seems to be going to fall on HFC. And if we have the same sort of thing as we had with the federal programs across the country with the savings and loans, what happens is the government eats all the risk and eats most of the, absorbs most of the losses, and then you start over with a lower base.
Representative Navarro, I think that you're talking about the distortion in the marketplace that occurred, and it occurred because of the subsidy for single-family homes when interest rates were high, both in rural Alaska and also in the urban areas. And I think that part of the heartburn that so many legislators had over the 5% arbitrage program was because of that similar view. What we're really talking about is HFC's ability to access normal capital markets in a market-driven economy without subsidy with that single-family loan. What happened when interest rates shifted was, at first the legislature thought they were giving rural Alaskans a break because it was a little bit deeper subsidy, but then upon examination, what they found was that most of the rural portfolio was in good shape, that HFC could actually go out and bond for that without subsidy, and that there wasn't as high a foreclosure rate risk because people had no place to go. When they moved, they're in a small community, they tend to stay in their home. So those loans are relatively decent. I guess what I'm saying, though, is that, and I think what Jan is saying, is that the normal secondary markets probably aren't going to go into the rural areas regardless, because there's lots of reasons, you know, fire protection, you know, they don't understand foundations or, you know, non-conventional building techniques, or our unique problems. You say permafrost or permafrost lenses to somebody who's sitting in San Francisco or New York or, you know, Boston, or, you know, and they'll say, what? You know, why would anybody possibly want to lend on that? And also the whole question of Alaska's economy as a whole.
Well, you know, I'd like to say, you know, as far as the quality of the portfolio, the rural portfolio has the lowest default rate. The rural portfolio has the lowest delinquency rate. The rural portfolio in largely southeast Alaska carried the rest of the state during the last recession. And the reason National Bank of Alaska survived and those eight other banks failed is because the nucleus of our power was in southeast Alaska. So I don't. The fact is the people that took the losses on the mortgages were not the people that financed at the lower end. The people, the expensive homes on the hillside and things that in Anchorage, where there was some, you know, when 20% of the population packed up their bags and left town. So I don't. You know, to answer your question without giving an additional thought about how much of the portfolio could be displaced, I can't say right now, but I think you'd have even Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac or government programs, you know, they're not interested in going out to know. And, you know, I mean, I have conversations with those folks. I talk to them about apartment projects. They say from 10 miles from my office in Anchorage, Alaska, is where they're interested in lending, and don't bother us bringing us projects from anyplace else. So I don't know. I praise Alaska Housing Finance. The fact that they weathered the storm, they have strong capital, and they're helping the people of the state of Alaska and the low to moderate income people, which they were really originally designed to do. I have to compliment them. The one other thing is a lot of their portfolio now has aged to the extent that the mortgages in their portfolio, I think, are far better off as withstanding another economic downturn than it was. You know, I mean, what all the 100% home financing and everything that went on in the, you know, late 70s and early 80s, everyone got carried away. I don't know. I can't place the blame on any one particular entity. I can't blame it on oil prices dropping. There's a lot of factors that went into that, I think. You know, I don't see that happening to us again for the foreseeable future.
Just for the record, there's a number of other reasons why their bank was more successful.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have to clarify for the record some of the statements that Representative Martin brought up. he referenced Alaska Railroad. I think that's a significantly differently situated entity now. They're not under the Executive Budget Act, and AHFC is for their budget, and that's why we spent so much time debating it the other day. As far as that ICER report that came up about weatherization, that report, and I haven't had chance to look into all the particulars of it, but I think it's way an overstatement to say that they've exercised poor responsibility. That was looking at payback rates in the community with the very lowest cost of energy in the country, and the statistics are significantly different everywhere else other than Anchorage. The merger is 3 years old, not 2 years old. And I was participated quite a bit in the discussions that led up to the merger. It was my bill, although my bill wasn't the one that actually passed, but I'd worked the bill for several years, and then we did have a special session. Governor Hickel agreed to reintroduce the bill that was near passage. And these statements that he's continually making about how there's no oversight and nobody thought of all these things, it's just not correct. And I believe if you would check into the record of what went on at the time, you would find that that in fact was considered and was debated, what was the right level of oversight. And, you know, we used to have no oversight over ASHA. And then we had the DCRA program over here. So it really was hard for people to see what our total housing program was. And I think, I continue to think that the merger did make sense, does make sense, is doing a good thing. And I think if you come back to say, what's really the underlying purpose and why do we need this? It's because we still have a shortage of decent, affordable housing for people. A majority of the housing stock is not energy efficient, will not hold a decent indoor temperature, or not a majority, but a large percentage, like more than 25%. There's a lot of poor quality housing out there, and AHFC needs the flexibility to be able to function. I don't know which cap, or whether it's best to cap the project or cap AHFC's participation, but I am in favor of the committee substitute and some variation of it.
Thank you. Just for everybody's information, there's been a lot of questions. We're going to send it to a subcommittee that will be chaired by Representative Martin, and members will be Representative Coring and Navarre. And there will be some good discussions going on, I'm sure, between the members of the...
Mr. Chairman, as a kind of a wrap-up, I'm going to say something as a wrap-up. I'm kind of amazed that the gentleman from the NBA would say that the Royal portfolio is carrying the other portfolio. From what we've seen, and I'll be glad to give you an in-depth report, not from my narrow-minded, stupid block, but from professional people, in the real estate people, it shows us that you have in our Royal communities, for whatever reasons, homes that are $100,000, $160,000, and the individuals are paying $125,000 to $250,000. The gentleman from the Bering Sea regional area told me that their average charge is $100,000 and $250,000 per month. They go from $50,000 to $700,000. Well, no way in the world can that ever pay for the house, the principal. It hardly pays the interest on the loan. And I can't conceive how you can say from the books that we have received from Alaska Housing that the Royal community is carrying the portfolio for Alaska Housing. You know, when you get hundreds of millions of dollars for nothing, free money except that the national government goes in debt, then you're competing with the free market. And the only way the free market is paying right now is anyone who has the stupidity of raising enough money over $36,000 a year, then you're not qualified. You have to pay $15,000, $1,500 a month for your home rather than $125,000 or $250,000. So there's a lot of things that we really need to bat around, and I didn't get into it until last year only because of the committee I sat on. And all of us on that committee were just shocked because we as legislators let it go too long to see how big this monster is getting. Oh, it's fabulously successful. Well, anytime you run a business where you can get $100 and $150 million and $200 million from federal government for nothing, you can be very successful.
Yep. Well, when I was talking, Representative Martin, when I was talking about carrying the portfolio, what I was talking about, default rates and delinquency rates, and traditionally and today, the delinquency rates in the portfolio we service for Alaska Housing in rural Alaska is outperforms the urban centers.
Well, maybe you should put more emphasis on the urban area. Forget the Boyle.
well, if they're performing better, I think they put more emphasis in the rural areas if they're going to make money. But Representative Coring, then we're going to wrap up. We're going to get to the next bill. We'll be going to a subcommittee. And
just want to make this brief by saying that it's obvious that the discussion that's unfolded here has identified that there's clear divisions on this issue, and I think it's the wise thing to do to discuss it at the subcommittee level instead of rushing into this thing before any final decisions are made, so I appreciate that very much.
Okay. So at this point, I'm going to send it to a subcommittee chaired by Representative Martin with members Coring and Navarre, and they can bring it back. I expect Representative Martin's interested in this, so it's not
Well, won't delay, because I know the Senate wants to do something with the two this year instead of letting it go another year, because it is a major financial problem.
So if you would let me know, Representative Martin, when you're ready to have it back before the committee.
Next couple mornings, so I'd like to have a subcommittee. I'll let you know the time and we'll announce it.
Okay, well, just be aware we do have finance committee meetings in the morning.
I didn't know when you were going to meet. I'll get with you.
Mr. Chairman, John Bitney, I just wanted to make clear, if this is a Senate bill and if something does pass this year, it may be necessary to craft some. The bill doesn't have an effective date on it, so it may become necessary to craft some appropriation language to pick up whatever functions aren't under the Executive Budget Act now that will be if the bill were to pass this year.
The conference
we would just discuss that with you as part of some appropriation bill later in the session.
Great, thank
Good
you.
Good point, John.
For everybody's information, we are not taking up House Bill 78, which is the welfare reform today. We'll re-notice that. Everybody else had been told, Ralph, so I figured you might know that. We are going to take up House Bill 257. And
who's seconded?
Mr. McCormick, did you want to join us? And if you could, for the record, just identify yourself and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Hanley. My name is Joe McCormick. I am the Executive Director of the Alaska Commission on Postsecondary Education. Very briefly, I'd like to outline for you the three major objectives of this bill. One, it will improve customer service of the Alaska Student Loan Program. Two, it strengthens the financial stability and the independence of the loan program. And three, it will provide for an improved overall program administration. Under the objective of improved customer service, we are recommending that the graduate loan limits be increased from the current $6,500 per year to $9,500. That you raise the undergraduate loan limits from the current $5,500 to $8,500 per year at degree-granting schools. I would hasten to point out in this recommendation that the University of Alaska has increased its tuition 250% over the last 10 years. However, the last time the Alaska legislature raised the loan limits was 1981. That provision provides that the career education programs of 9 months in length or longer remain at a $5,500 loan limit, and that career education programs of less than 9 months would be limited to $3,000. Section 3 increases the consumer protection provision of the commission by giving us the ability to ensure the financial and the administrative capability of schools that use the Alaska Student Loan Program by ensuring, one, that they operate on a physically sound basis, two, they have been in operation for 2 years before the borrower attends, and three, they have executed a program participation agreement with the commission, which by and large acknowledges that they will abide by all the rules and regulations and the statutes governing the loan program. Section 4 provides greater flexibility to both the borrower and the commission by setting the maximum amount that a student may borrow in terms of dollar amounts rather than the number of years that a student has been receiving loans. It would set the maximum for undergraduate study at $42,000, the maximum for graduate study at $47,500, for a combined total not to exceed $79,000 per student. Section 6, we recommend the terms of repayment be extended from the traditional 10-year repayment to a maximum of 15 years for high indebtedness loans. Two, decrease the grace period from 12 to 6 months. In the student loan industry, it is common knowledge that that the sooner you get a student into repayment and they make payments on a regular basis, the less likely they will default. So we would like to shorten that grace period for that reason. And last, set a minimum monthly repayment at $50 per month for students. We would also, in Section 12, recommend that the technical definition in the law as to when a loan goes into default change from a current 120 days to 180 days. This will allow the student another 60 days to work with staff of the commission to avoid the loan going into default and avoid his permanent fund being garnished, avoid his credit rating being ruined, and avoid ultimately a judgment being taken against the student in a court of law. We would like an additional 60 days to work with the students to avoid those things from happening. Section 16, 21, and 27 deal with a little known problem in the loan program. You have actually two loan programs. You have the Alaska Student Loan Program and the Family Education Loan. And under current law, if the student borrows, the parent cannot. So when you have a student whose total cost of education exceeds, say, $15,000, and he borrows the current $5,500 to help defray those costs, his parents cannot borrow under our Family Education Loan Program to make up the difference in those two figures. This provision would simply allow the student to borrow under the student loan program and the parent to borrow under the FEL program so that they could come closer to meeting that total cost of education. Section 26 allows us simply to assess a fee for institutions outside the state who wish to participate in the student loan program, and that would help offset the cost of issuing the participation for those schools. The second objective, increasing the financial viability of the program. One, under Section 5, we would like to eliminate interest-free deferment periods. The law very correctly provides for, during certain periods of a student's repayment, they may defer those repayments. For one, if they go back to school. Two, if they suffer a temporary hardship. Three, if they join the military service. And under your current law, when those periods of deferment occur, interest stops on the loan. We recommend that interest continue to accrue on the loans and they be allowed to pay the interest or to have that interest capitalized and added to the loan principal. Secondly, Section 14 allows the commission to set the origination fee by regulation as opposed to it being set in statute. Currently, you have a 1% loan origination fee. We recommend that you change the statute to allow for a fee from 0 to 5%, not to exceed 5%. And that amount would be determined by the commission so that we would not have to come back year after year to ask for different fee levels. This fee is dedicated to losses incurred in the loan program due to death, disability, and or default. This loan fund, unlike the Alaska Housing Authority, is not guaranteed by anybody. If we have a default, we suffer a loss. We need the origination fee as a way to be one step closer toward a more financially sound program. Section 18 would provide that delinquent student loans be given a priority second only to childhood in the enforcement of wage garnishments in the state of Alaska. This is a current practice with PFD garnishments, and it has proved to be quite successful over the years. Now, the third objective of improving overall program administration, very quickly, Sections 8, 15, 20, 24, and 27 are merely technical changes which eliminate costly and unnecessary mailings to borrowers. Two, require that illegally obtained loans be paid in full upon demand. And three, removes an arbitrary cap on loan volume. This arbitrary cap on loan volume is very important in that we anticipate there may be a sharp increase in the level of borrowing next year because the tuition increase at the University of Alaska. There is currently in the law a prohibition against the loan volume increasing more than 3% from 1 year to the next, and we would like that cap removed. In conclusion, we simply are providing you a piece of legislation that, if enacted, will better assure that the future generations of Alaskans yet to borrow from this fund will have it available when they need it. We would be glad to answer any questions you may have about the legislation at this time. Thank you.
Maybe you could tell us, if we don't do anything, when do we run out of money? Or when will we stop being able to get bonds sold, or whichever way you want to?
Chairman Hanley, due to the over-collateralized nature of the loan fund, it would take you several years to truly run out of money. But due to the fact that since 1988, we are dependent on the issuance of tax-exempt bonds, it would probably take no more than 3 years before we would reach a point that we could not issue bonds. No one in New York would buy the bonds. So if this legislation is not passed, if we do not address our loan servicing problems as is proposed in the capital budget, I would say in about 3 years we will be out of the bond business.
And how much a year is that, $40
million? We've been doing somewhere between $40 and $50 million a year in issuing of bonds.
Representative Brown.
Thank you. I did have a couple of questions. Generally, I commend you, Mr. McCormick, for coming forward with a plan to make this fund self-sustaining. Let me ask, if we pass this, would the fund be self-sustaining, or do we still have leakage problems and other concerns that would crop up again down the road?
Representative Brown, that is a very important question. I'm glad that you ask it. We would not be financially sound. We would not be 100% whole by just passing this legislation. Probably the most dramatic example of that is that since the program began, we have not charged interest on the loan while students were in school. And that averages from 2.5 to 4 years that they would be in school before they go into repayment. Until we actually do charge interest during those periods, we could not say the program would be financially sound. The commission chose not to include that in this legislation for political reasons, feeling that we probably could not get that passed during this session. But I can assure you that as time goes by and we gain in confidence and the legislature gains in confidence in what we're doing, that definitely probably in the future will be a recommendation that we bring to you.
Could I continue? A few more questions. What would be the effect of this bill on your typical borrower? How would the average student who's seeking money here notice the changes? What are the changes that would be most of importance to the student?
Representative Brown, 70% of the students who borrow from the program borrow from to go to the University of Alaska. The major impact to them would be they would now have a loan limit of $8,500 if they were a undergraduate student, or if they were in graduate school, they would have a $9,500 loan limit as opposed to the current $5,500 limit. That would probably be the most immediate, the most visible impact that you would see in the loan program of all these changes.
Which presumably would make it possible for people to borrow more. Would that put a greater strain on the resources of the corporation?
It would increase, we're estimating, from 10 to 20% loan volume, loan demand for the coming year, which probably would mean that we would have to increase the size of the bond issue for this coming year. We are actually holding off on making a decision as to what amount of bonds to issue until the legislature has acted on this legislation.
Mr. Chairman, we've received a couple pieces of correspondence in our file from people concerned about the language on page 2, item 4, line 3, about the vocational, the limits on the career education programs, and I was wondering what was the commission's thought in making that reduction to $3,000 for a full-time student.
Representative Brown, Chairman Hanley, if I could clarify that in a very real sense, the commission could not come to terms with a consensus on what the loan limit should be. The loan limits that actually wound up in this legislation were staff recommendations that we put in there on the basis of data that we had. on the basis of what we anticipated the increase in the fees the University of Alaska would be. The reason that we recommended there be no increase in the career education programs and that there actually be a reduction for short-term programs stems from the history of the loan program in relation to default rates of those types of institutions. For programs of study that are less than 9 months in length, we have default rates ranging from 24% up to as high as 56%. What we are saying with provision number four, that only $3,000 be allowed to a full-time student if he's attending a career education program that is less than 9 months in length, we're simply saying we're not willing to risk more than $3,000 for you to take this course. We are not saying that they cannot take the course. We're simply saying that given that the average cost of these programs is around $4,800, we don't feel that the loan program should finance those programs at 100% when, in fact, they represent a very high risk to the portfolio. And if we are going to be financially responsible to the loan program, we have to take that into account as well.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I could continue. But our philosophy is if you're going to go to the University of Alaska, we are raising the limits in order to, I presume, to enable people to borrow 100% to be able to go. And I guess I'm just kind of struggling with that because it seems like we do have a public interest in making it possible for people to obtain vocational education. And although yes. The risk might be somewhat higher, it seems like we might be excluding people from being able to take that type of training if the cost of it's $4,800 and we're only willing to loan them $3,000. That's a, you know, where's the equity or in that and treating this group of students this way and the ones that are headed for the university differently?
Representative Brown, the University of Alaska has budgets set up for students depending on whether they're single, living on campus or off campus, whether they're married, have children, that range from, I think, a low of $9,000 per year for an entire year, and a high of, say, if they're married and have two children, of $18,000. So we are in no way, with an $8,500 loan limit, financing 100% of that cost. And it's also very important to keep in mind that's for a full year of study. And we're saying for a program of instruction that's only 20 weeks in length, it is not reasonable from a financial standpoint to finance $5,500 of that when you will not, under current law, finance more than $5,500 for a student attending the University of Alaska. And I do not feel, as others feel, that will probably testify today, that I've denied the student the opportunity to attend those short-term programs. I have simply limited the amount of money that he has to borrow to pay the cost of that. And I'm not trying to speak to their cost, whether they're reasonable or unreasonable. I'm just trying to give you a different perspective on it.
Another question that I had, Mr. Chairman, related to the fiscal impact of the bill. And the fiscal note that I see is zero, and I'm just wondering how you arrived at the conclusion that the cost was zero. I can think of costs. In fact, you have a budget proposal pending before us for, what is it, $1.6 million or some large number to redo the automated system, and I'm just wondering, this would seem to have this would drive many changes in the automated system. So I'm finding it hard to see how you're getting a zero there. And then I guess you're going to be maybe collecting better. And, you know, did you net out the income and the outgo and conclude it was really a zero impact on you?
Representative Brown, to give you a zero fiscal statement is to say to you, I will absorb the cost of making all these changes in two places. One, my current operating budget, and two, the capital budget request that we have pending. So assuming that capital budget request is approved, I will absorb in my current budget, that hopefully will be approved also this year, the changes, the cost of the changes that this bill generates. So I'm not asking for money on top of the funds I've already asked for. and that's a reasonable request. We can do that.
If the capital budget project were not approved, would you be showing a fiscal note on this legislation?
We possibly would have costs that are not currently covered in the fiscal note. I have not run the numbers on that, but this would represent changes to the existing program that would have to be made, and it might be that we would have to do a revision to the LB&A committee or something like that at some point later in the year.
And then looking to section 25 of the bill on page 10, the changes that are made with respect to Wichee.
We'll move it today.
What is the reason for the change, and what is the status of Wichee participation under this budget that's before us?
Representative Brown, this change was an attempt to bring the Wichee participation up to date, if you will. As you see, the part of the statute that we are eliminating specifies exactly what fields of study we can consider for Wichee students. The new language says we would ask that the commission, in cooperation with studies from the Department of Commerce, the Department of Labor, determine which programs have the highest priority, and we fund those students, simply because the funding for Wichee has dwindled so much over the past few years. There's no way that we could provide funds for all of these categories that are in the existing legislation. Now, it's my understanding in both the House and the Senate operating budgets, there is no new money for Wichee for new students, so it almost makes this section of the legislation moot in that if we go forward with no new funds for new Wichee students this year, that will be 2 years in a row with no new students, and I would say for all intent and purposes, you are no longer in the Wichee program.
Okay.